Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
This week's show is sponsored by Audible, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow liberals and Democrats, inquisitive Republicans, and concerned citizens of all backgrounds, welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Welcome aboard, and let's get to work. We have two amazing guests for you today. First, Pat Buchanan. Whatever your opinion is of Pat Buchanan, he's known for his sharp debate skills, and he has the experience of serving the administrations of no less than three presidents. He joins us today to talk about Syria. Then we will have Jack Cloonan, who is the senior case agent assigned to the Bin Laden squad in the New York office of the FBI. He will be talking about the FBI's fight against Al-Qaeda and the controversy about enhanced interrogation. Additionally, we will have our trademark Weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. So we'll get started right after this.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business, makes you sensational.
I'd like to welcome Pat Buchanan to the show. Pat has been a senior advisor to three presidents, a two-time candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, and was the presidential nominee of the Reform Party in 2000. From 66 to 74, he was an assistant to Richard Nixon. From 85 to 87, he was White House Director of Communications for Ronald Reagan. And in 1992, Mr. Buchanan challenged George Bush for the Republican nomination and almost upset the president in the New Hampshire primary. Mr. Buchanan has written 10 books, including six straight New York Times bestsellers, A Republic, Not an Empire, The Death of the West, Where the Right Went Wrong, State of Emergency, Day of Reckoning and Churchill, Hitler and the Unnecessary War, and he is the first conservative of any stripe that I have had on my show. So welcome to the show, Pat.
Good to talk with you.
It's really a pleasure. You know, I spent a lot of time in my youth, in addition to doing all the regular things that a kid and teenager does, watching Capital Gang and Crossfire and things like that. So it's really an honor to have you on my show, even though we disagree on probably a great many things. But starting off, do you think that the president's policy in Syria has been the right policy? I had Congressman Grayson on my show 2 weeks ago. He disagrees with the president's policy in Syria, doesn't think that we should strike Syria under any circumstances. Then I had former Assistant Secretary of State P.J. Crowley on last week, and he thinks, or at least he did prior to the possibility of a compromise, that we have to strike Syria to send a message to other countries that the use of chemical weapons is unacceptable. So what do you think about the president's Syria policy, and what should it be?
I don't think you bomb and kill people to send messages. So, no, I disagree with the president's idea of airstrikes on Syria. I think when he said that Assad must go and that I have a red line on the use of chemical weapons or even the movement of chemical weapons, he was issuing basically ultimatums that he does not have the authority to carry out. No one has authorized Barack Obama to take us to war against a country that has not attacked us and does not threaten us. I mean, he can't go around and serve basically as the sheriff of the world, night-sticking those whom displease him, especially if these are acts of war. So I think the president made a terrible mistake in issuing these idle threats, if you will, and then he suddenly found out that not only did the American people not back him, the military doesn't back him, and the Congress doesn't back him, and the Security Council doesn't back him.
Yeah. Yeah, I find myself agreeing with a lot of what you've been saying regarding Syria regarding the president. I think the president's policy in Syria has been a mistake from the get-go. That whole red line was a huge mistake. Supporting the rebels was a mistake. And that was before the suggestion of us getting involved with force came into the picture. My opposition to the president's policy in Syria just grew exponentially at that point. But one thing I was curious about was your praise for Putin and his op-ed when you were on Greta Van Susteren's show the other day. Can you talk about that, if you would?
Sure. I mean, I was shown the Putin op-ed about 10 minutes before the Greta show began, and I read it and read it quickly twice. And I noticed in it that Putin was clearly making arguments against American military action, which I thought were far more forceful and correct than President Obama's arguments the night before in favor of military action. Secondly, the fact today that that the hysterical reaction of the America's elite, Republican, Democrat, Independent, in this city in Washington, D.C., suggests that Putin really set down the cat among the pigeons. I've done any number of television shows, and everyone is talking about Putin's letter. Now, in the substance of his letter, I find an enormous amount to agree with. Very deftly stated, he almost takes a stance in his argument as something of an anti-war or anti-interventionist conservative Republican who has religious values, and with the references to God and the Pope and even invocations of Jefferson's "All men are created equal." So I thought it was an outstanding piece of political propaganda, very deftly written, well-argued, not insulting to the United States, but toughly challenging the United States. And when you see the reaction that there is to it, how he is basically, his arguments drive a wedge through the American body politic, I think you have to agree it's very, very effective.
But should anybody be buying it? I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head a little bit there when you talked about, piece of political theater and propaganda there. I mean, no one disputes that Putin was skilled in his use of the opportunity he had, but bringing up American exceptionalism, appearing to be anti-war, that was what really got me, Pat. I mean, can you really make the case that Putin is anti-war? Back in 1999, his primary...
What you're doing is not addressing his arguments. You're telling me that you don't like Putin. And I understand that, and you don't like Putin's record. And I understand
I probably
would agree with a good part of it. But if you take the letter in and of itself, for example, I mean, he describes the terrorist elements inside the rebellion. He describes jihadists coming into Syria and being let in, both Russians and Americans and others, and that they're going to get, people will get experience here who will come out and bring their terrorism inside our own countries, and this is a possible result or a probable result of an American airstrike, and I think he's dead right. He mentioned
what does he really stand for, though? I mean, he's not anti-war. He's anti whatever the United States happens to be doing at that moment. 5 years ago, he engaged in a war against Georgia. He engaged in a war in 1999 against Chechnya.
All right, what he stands for, he's a Russian patriot. He's a Russian nationalist. He's former KGB, a very tough customer, and he probably is deeply wounded by what has happened to the mighty superpower where he joined the security forces as a young man. Now, you're mistaken about the invasion of Georgia. What happened there in 2008 was that Saakashvili sent his troops into South Ossetia. And in doing so, he killed Russian peacekeepers as well as trying to recapture a province that had broken away from him 20 years ago and had the same right to break away from Georgia as Georgia did to break away from the Soviet Union. And after Saakashvili invaded, the Russian army came through that tunnel, went into South Ossetia, threw the Georgians out, and went into Georgia partway and gave them a thrashing because of what the Georgians had done. Now, I know John McCain was running around saying we are all Georgians now and wanting us to get involved in a war with Russia over Georgia, but that had been an absurdity. So, I mean, in Chechnya, Putin put that down with enormous brutality. I mean, you hear reports of hundreds of thousands dead. But again, Mr. Lincoln put down the secession movement and the rebellion in the American South, doing a little considerable damage to the land for which my ancestors fought. So, I mean, I'm not saying this man is a saint. He's a very tough customer. But I think when he puts up an argument there, I judge it, I've shaken hands with a lot worse people than Vladimir Putin when I worked for Nixon and Reagan. But when he makes an argument like this, I think it is an effective piece because he drove a wedge right between the American electorate, between those who really don't want war and those who do, and in the international community, his attack on American exceptionalism or American claims to be an exceptional nation, and therefore it has certain rights and prerogatives worldwide, you know, the indispensable nation talk of Madeleine Albright, he strikes a chord with countries all over the world. So, and again, take a look at the reaction from the people down here in Washington in the journalistic and political community to a simple op-ed that no one would have paid attention to if someone else had written it.
Well, I mean, I think people are having the same reaction as if Kim Jong-un had written that type of an op-ed. I mean, it's ridiculous, really, coming from who wrote it, but I think we disagree on that part. Let me move on here
Kim Jong-un. I've seen their op-eds, the Democratic Republic of Korea, the New York Times for years have been taking money from these characters, putting their full-page ads in the New York Times, and nobody reads them or pays attention to them. But look at the reaction. I haven't done a television or radio show in 3 days that wasn't devoted to Putin's op-ed. I mean, I think he's been signed up by the Washington Post Writers Group.
He might have been. But I want to move on just for a second because, really, I mean, hasn't Assad killed as freely as he has? Hasn't the situation deteriorated as it has because, essentially, Assad knows that Russia has his back? Hasn't Russia enabled Assad to be the brutal dictator that he is? Russia sold him arms. Russia wields an implied veto at the Security Council. Doesn't it take unmitigated gall for Putin to lecture us about intervention in this situation, given Russia's role in it to this point? Isn't Russia and Putin enabling all that's going on there? And why hasn't Putin acted more forcefully before now to try to enact a solution there? I mean, this op-ed's a little late, isn't it?
Well, no, I will say the president's not entirely wrong. I mean, when he says that the threat of force got everybody's attention, that's undeniably true. But let's take a look at the situation in international law. The Assad government, the son of Hafez al-Assad, with whom George H.W. Bush allied in the Gulf War. He brought Syria into the war. The Syrians contributed 4,000 troops to the American cause. I remember Nixon in 1974, we went into Syria to reestablish ties to Syria. It's Hafez al-Assad and his son Bashar al-Assad have been running the place for 43 years. They're the legitimate recognized government. The Russians have had a relationship with that government for virtually that entire time. They've got the port of Latakia. They have a base there. They have every right to provide arms to a friendly country and an allied country which is undergoing an insurrection, an insurgency, and a rebellion supported by people pouring in arms from the outside, including the United States of America. Now, in international law, I mean, I'm not sure where the Russians are wrong here and we are more right. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that the initial people trying to demonstrate and overthrow Assad were far morally superior, in my judgment. I would have preferred them to Assad's regime. But I don't know why you fault the Russian government for standing by their ally when the United States government took 3 weeks to abandon our ally of 30 years, Hosni Mubarak.
This is a guy that Russia has been supporting, as you rightly say, for years and years and years, and now all of a sudden at the last moment they're trying to force a situation, a solution after 100,000 people have died. I mean, you can't...
100,000 people have died because there's been a rebellion.
All sides.
And the army is put down.
Well, you yourself said that you'd rather have the rebels involved in charge of Syria than Assad, right? So you can't exactly fault the rebels for having a rebellion if you think that they would be better.
No, the reason I oppose the overthrow of Assad, and even Obama says we don't want to overthrow the regime with our airstrikes or missile strikes. And the reason Kerry wants to have an unbelievably small strike is because they're afraid if they overthrow Assad and his government disintegrates, the people who will take power will be these Al-Qaeda elements who have been for the last week murdering Christians and cutting their throats and beheading them if they don't convert in Malula. We have on the side of the rebels some of the most odious, awful elements in the world and in the Middle East, the people who took down our towers. And this is why Putin's letter is effective. He's been saying, in effect, why are you Americans providing weapons to the very to a rebel group, the strongest element of which is related to the people that murdered 3,000 Americans? It's a very good question.
It is a good question. You and I happen to agree there, and I agree with Putin on that piece, and I've been saying that actually for a while.
No.
I don't stand up for somebody when they're wrong. I never do that. But you said that if the president goes to war in Syria without congressional authorization, it would be an impeachable offense.
It would be, but I wouldn't impeach him because I think the American black community has an enormous psychic and emotional, and it believes a political stake in him. And I think that would be terrible for the country. But I do believe it would be an impeachable offense if, in the face of the opposition of his countrymen, the opposition of his military, 80% of whom disagreed with his speech, and the opposition of the Congress of the United States, he launched a war in the absence of any attack upon this country or threat to this country, he would be in violation of the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 8. It reserves to Congress alone the authority to declare war or to authorize war. So I think that just as the Security Council hasn't given him any authority to go to war, neither has the Congress, which has the power, has that power. And so by what right does he run around bombing people?
You know, on the one hand, I agree with you very much there, Pat. But on the other, I have to point out that you did serve in the Reagan administration, and Ronald Reagan invaded Grenada with no congressional authorization. So if you think Obama should be impeached if he attacks Syria, shouldn't Reagan have been impeached for invading Grenada without congressional authorization?
No. Let me tell you why. In the absence of an attack or a threatened attack on the United States, you need to get congressional authorization. Reagan was accosted on a golf course and told that the group of Marxist thugs who had overthrown Maurice Bishop, and I was with it, who had overthrown Maurice Bishop, who was a non-thuggish Marxist, but he was a puppet of the Soviets, that he had been overthrown and murdered, and these thugs were in Grenada, a tiny island, and you had 500 American medical students who were in imminent danger of being taken hostage. That is an issue on which you cannot go to the Congress of the United States. You have to move, but then you inform the Congress. I also worked with Ronald Reagan directly and personally on his speech on Libya. Now, he struck Libya without going to the Congress. Why did he do it? Because Libya had struck us in Berlin, they blew up a discotheque where black American soldiers were, and they killed several and wounded 50. And this was a strike back at the headquarters of the Libyan intelligence responsible. It was a surprise counterattack. And to maintain the element of surprise, he could not go to the Congress and announce, "I'm thinking of it." Otherwise, it might have been preemptive action. So he had a powerful argument there. But there, look, Syria doesn't threaten us. They're not going to throw any nerve gas at us. We have all the time in the world, as the president has said, the generals tell him, look, Syria will be there tomorrow. It will be there next week. It will be there a month from now. So if there were an imminent threat, the president's got the authority and power to use military force to deal with it. But as there is none, and as the president will be starting a brand new war in the Middle East, and a major war, he has got to get the authorization of Congress.
Okay. So
I'm going to let you have the last word here. And the last question for the last word is, if you were made president today, you ran for president 3 times. If you were made president today, what would be your policy dealing with Syria?
My policy dealing with Syria is that I would take a look at the situation and I would say the main primary interest of the United States is we do not want people to control parts or all of Syria who are related to our real enemies, Al-Qaeda. Assad is a bad man, but he's not an enemy of the United States in terms of that he's a threat to the United States. And so what I would do is I would work with the Russians and the Iranians, and I would say, look, none of us wants a wider war, but this thing threatens a wider war, and you Iranians are the ones who have been doused with more poison gas in this last century than anyone. And we all know that poison gas has been used, and we all know that this is going to have a political settlement, otherwise it's going to expand, and none of us wants an American-Iranian war or American-Syrian war. And so let's get together, and I would bring in the Turks, who seem to be anxious to have us fight and not fight themselves, and so do the Israelis. And so that's who I would bring in, all the parties, and see if we could find some kind of settlement to end this. But darn if I would be – look, Obama says we don't want to – we're not looking for a regime change. However, I'm going to give guns and weapons to the rebels who want regime change. Now, that may make sense to you, but it doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it doesn't make any sense to me either. Thank you so much. Patrick Buchanan, an advisor to 3 presidents, presidential candidate himself, author of 10 books, including 6 straight to the bestseller list, and again, the first conservative ever to appear on my show. Thank you so much, Pat. I really appreciate it.
Take it easy. Bye-bye. We don't get fooled again.
Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible. Listeners of Making Sense with Steve Laser can get a free audiobook and 30-day trial membership if they sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/lasersense. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. For instance, Inferno, the latest novel by Dan Brown, is available, as is The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Sign up now at www.audiblepodcast.com/lasersense.
I'd like to welcome former FBI Special Agent Jack Clunan to the show. From 1996 to 2002, Clunan was the senior case agent assigned to the Bin Laden Squad in the New York office of the FBI. The Bin Laden Squad, if you've never heard the term, they were charged with the responsibility of building a prosecutable case against Osama bin Laden and against other folks like Ayman al-Zawahiri and other high-ranking members of al-Qaeda. And in that role, Clunan traveled globally, finding members of al-Qaeda, gaining their cooperation to assist in the prosecution of those who carried out the deadly attacks on U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Kenya and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And as a result of these activities, Clunan gained some real insight into how al-Qaeda worked from those al-Qaeda insiders who agreed to cooperate with the U.S. voluntarily. Clunan is a consultant on terrorism for ABC News, and although the term is a bit overused these days, he and his team were some of the real heroes
in the fight against Al-Qaeda. So welcome to the show, Mr. Clunan.
Thank you very much, Steve. Nice to be here.
It's great having you. So let me jump right in. How did you come to be involved with the efforts against Al-Qaeda?
Well, in late December 1995, early 1996, the then director of Central Intelligence signed a what they called a presidential finding. It was an intelligence finding that was presented to the then President Clinton, which outlined rather broadly that this group called Al-Qaeda and its leader, Osama bin Laden, posed a threat to U.S. national security. It's a much broader finding, but that's kind of the gist of it. And as a consequence, it came that there was a sort of a three-prong approach where the CIA was certainly working it, the NSA was certainly doing what it does, and the Justice Department was asked or tasked to build a prosecutable case against bin Laden, as you mentioned in your introduction. And as a consequence, the Southern District of New York, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, and the New York Office of the FBI was tasked with that objective. And that's how it all evolved.
And that was back in 1996, right?
1996, it began in earnest, yes.
Okay, and then almost right away, in 1996, a man by the name of Jamal al-Fadl literally falls into your lap. What did he mean to your team?
Well, I sort of chuckle a little bit when we talk about Jamal and that he fell into our laps, because it would, you know, Jamal was in some respects shopping himself around. He had touched base with the Saudis and some other intelligence services, so I think we're a bit suspect of him. But when he walked into the U.S. Embassy in Eritrea, he was initially debriefed by the regional security officer from State Department and a representative from the CIA. Because of that presidential finding that I alluded to earlier, we were made aware of it, and a brilliant attorney named Pat Fitzgerald from the Southern District of New York and one of my colleagues, Dan Coleman, were dispatched to debrief Jamal, which they did in country, in Eritrea, and then they moved him voluntarily, if you will, to Germany, and they debriefed him over probably a 10-day period, as I recall, and that was a real eye-opener. At that point in 1996, early on, we were still struggling to figure out what it was that Al-Qaeda was all about. We had sort of a rudimentary idea, but then having Jamal come in and talk to us, it opened up the whole idea of what Al-Qaeda was. It gave an insight into its structure. It started to identify individuals who were playing roles, and that this wasn't just an organization of like-minded people who were doing charitable work. We found out a lot about what their intents were, how they operated, what the level of potential threat it was to the United States, and it really kick-started the investigation dramatically.
And what was the impression that you got overall? Was Al-Qaeda, right at that moment, I mean, obviously the president doesn't issue findings and put together whole teams for something that's not a threat, but from the very beginning, did you have a sense that these guys were a real deal that needed to be kept in check and worried about by a good deal of folks? Or
even in the very early stages, we came to the conclusion that they did pose a threat. Did we understand at that point in time that the threat was global and that the United States was described by Al-Qaeda as one of its principal enemies? The answer is yes. What we didn't know was what sort of operational expertise that they had, what sort of funding was available, and how that manifested itself, who some of the key players were, even to the point where we understood largely through Jamal initially, who was closest to bin Laden, who was as some of the key decision makers. And so it became, it was demystified.
Okay.
And as a consequence, many of us found out, or many of us concluded, I should say, that it was far more organized than we had imagined. Yes, it was a diffuse network of people, and that was to some extent the genius of what Al-Qaeda was, because in Arabic it's described as the base. And so we learned what it was like to become a mujahideen, a jihadist, and what brought people into Afghanistan and the Sudan, how they were trained and how they were sent back to their own countries to do as they will. And so, again, we had an idea based largely on Jamal's debriefings, what a day in the life of Osama bin Laden was like, how the operation functioned from top to bottom, because it was a very organized structure, how religious orders, for example, that might authorize an attack.
Wow. Now, you're getting all this information from this guy. Now, how do you know that he's not feeding you disinformation? How did you verify that he was who he was and that his information was good?
You know, that's a very, very good question. And I will tell you that Pat Fitzgerald, who was the lead prosecutor at the time, and a fellow, by an attorney by the name of, I'm trying to remember his last name, I can't remember right now. We were always very suspect at first. You know, I think that expression that Ronald Reagan used, you know, trust but verify.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed to be able to corroborate a lot of what was said. You know, what was Jamal's motivation for cooperating with the United States? You know, what dirty laundry did he have? You know, and the way it was handled, I thought, was really quite brilliantly. He was treated as a cooperating witness. In other words, all the rights and privileges that attach to a cooperating witness in our legal system, you know, stuck to Jamal. There was no, lack of a better term, you know, threats against him. We treated him humanely. He was given legal counsel. And as it worked out, the longer he was exposed to our system of justice and how the FBI and prosecutors worked, the more comfortable he was. We weren't doing anything that we wouldn't do to any other subject or, frankly, that went on in any precinct station in New York City or with any trained, you know, interrogator or a good detective. We knew what the objective was, and through the course of time, as he got more and more confident with us, we got more and more confident with him. We just didn't, you know, everything that he said to us needed to be verified to the extent that we could. And, of course, one of the critical elements that you have in this is that when he starts to incriminate himself in activity, you know that you've sort of crossed a very important bridge. He knew, you know, at some point, and rather early on in our relationship, that there were no promises. He wasn't given, you know, the idea that, you know, he was going to be given a large amount of money to induce him to cooperate.
Oh, interesting. No money, no immunity or anything like that.
No, he knew that he was going to have to go into court, and I think the term is called allocute, and he was going to have to, you know, plead before a judge as to what he did. Now, the judge obviously is in charge of sentencing and has sentencing guidelines. But it was all done very transparently. It was his cooperation with the United States extended for a period of years. And he had a tremendous capacity. His memory was quite good. He had a tremendous capacity for recognizing photographs. And he would be able to tell you, for example, what somebody's particular code name was. He would be able to tell you, I think you should look for this guy. I think this guy is vulnerable and might be available for an approach if you could find him. I knew this guy. This is what his name was. This is what his job was. This is where I saw him. And this is what he did. Five, the commitment to go to the next level. And so, you know, again, not a fly-by-night organization. They weren't going to waste their human capital or their financial capital.
So Jamal, you know, if I could use the term, was an intelligence goldmine. And you interrogated him for years, got good information from him. But I don't want to completely concentrate on him. You also got good information from a number of other al-Qaeda operatives, like a guy by the name of Ali Abdul Saud Mohammed. Can you tell us about him and as much as you can about the information you got from him?
Well, Ali was certainly a unique character, very intelligent, a former colonel in the Egyptian Special Forces, who was mustered out of the Egyptian army in part because of his Islamic leanings, and there was some idea that he might have been connected in some way, somehow, to the assassination of Anwar Sadat. Wow. Never proven. But way back when, Ali became a protege of Zawahiri, bin Laden's number two man, when Ayman Zawahiri, Dr. Ayman Zawahiri, was basically the head of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, which eventually folds into al-Qaeda. And during that time, Zawahiri had tasked Ali to do various things. For example, we might want to hijack and blow up an Egyptian airliner. Can you please do research on how we could breach the security at an airport, how we might want to be able to take over that plane? Would it be best to be a suicide mission? That sort of thing. And then his taskings became even more important and, I suppose, aggressive, because ultimately he was directed to come to the United States and see if he could not get into the U.S. intelligence community, broadly speaking, in some shape or form. He joined after having, he worked as, I suppose, an agent he did work as an agent for the CIA for a period of time, for one operation, and they got rid of him because they didn't trust him, and he had basically given up the fact that he had worked for the agency, and he told the people that he was targeted against. He filed an application to join the FBI as a translator, and having failed in those two endeavors, he joins the U.S. Army, having been a colonel in the Egyptian Special Forces. And he was such a good, recruit, and given his past experience, he was sent to the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School after basic training.
Now, is this before or after his dealings with Zawahiri and
this
those folks?
This is all during. This is he's in contact with these people.
Wow.
Okay. I want to move this in a slightly different direction, but it's related to what we were just talking about. From what I've read, all this information that you got from Jamal al-Fadl and from Ali Abdul Saud Mohammed, you got them without ever using enhanced interrogation techniques like waterboarding or any of those things that came to be used later on any of these folks. Now, every qualified interrogator I've ever spoken with, and there have been a few, says that torture is not effective in getting you good information and that any real professional interrogator knows that. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, I would. I am familiar with some of the work that has been done over the years about how best to get information from people. certainly subjects that have been detained. And so, no, we did not use anything extraordinary because we knew that we would have to go into a court of law and have everything that we did, everything that we said, everything that we had written be open and transparent, potentially challenged, and ultimately, if we were successful, presented to a jury. So you always were operating under that mandate. It was sort of just like doing a regular criminal investigation that we were all accustomed to. Admittedly, this had high stakes, but it worked extremely well. There were obviously some issues that we had to address along the way. I think we had to convince some of our other government agencies that participated that, you know, who don't like to have things aired in a courtroom, that we could protect interests, we could protect sources and methods. So I would like nothing better than to have Jamal or Ali Abdul Saud or others who, if you will, were handled by the New York office of the FBI, tell their story. They knew.
But you know what? But I want to make sure one thing is really clear, though, Jack, if I could, and that is, sure, part of the reasoning is you have to deal with a jury; it's got to be all above board.
Yeah.
But it's more than that, right? It's the effectiveness, the effectiveness of treating them the right way, versus.
Of course,
you know,
yeah. We were able to not only sit and build trust with the suspects, or in this case, the cooperating witnesses, that's better put, they learned a lot about us in the process.
All right, we're going to have to end it there. Jack Clunan, former special agent in charge of the Bin Laden Squad, a real American hero who worked to keep us all safe and did it the right way, the moral way, and the effective way. Thanks so much for coming on the show, sir.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
The full and fascinating one-hour-long interview with Jack Clunan will be available on my blog, starting the evening of Monday, September 16th, on stevelaser.blogspot.com. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, Badler.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning our Hall of Fame this week for making great sense are none other than President Barack Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, I may disagree with President Obama's policy in Syria, and I may object to, quite frankly, a lot of things Russian President Putin has done, but both of them deserve credit for coming to the table and hammering out an agreement to resolve the situation with chemical weapons in Syria peacefully. Now, let's hope both men have learned some good lessons here. Let's hope President Obama has learned not to draw lines in the sand that could potentially commit the United States into a bad situation. And let's hope that President Putin stops aligning Russia's foreign policy by automatically fighting for the opposite of whatever the United States is doing. Oh, and how about repealing the homophobic legislation while you're at it, Vladimir Vladimirovich? President Barack Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin win our Hall of Fame this week for making great sense. But now we have our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense.
All aboard!
In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have Republican Colorado Congressman Mike Kaufman. In the last week of August, Congressman Kaufman spoke out on the possibility of President Obama striking Syria by saying, quote, "Since the United States is not in danger of an imminent attack, the president must follow the Constitution and the War Powers Act of 1973 and come to the Congress for support before going forward with a military strike of any kind." Now, I think that's fair enough, right? I'm against military action against Syria, and I agree that if any president is going to go to war, they should get congressional permission. But this past week, Representative Kaufman reversed himself, saying, quote, "The delay in striking Assad has wasted precious time. The Assad government has had all the time in the world to move their assets around so they don't present themselves as easy targets." So Congressman Kaufman goes from "you have to wait until we in the Congress give you permission" to "you've wasted precious time by delaying" in 10 days. Now, while that's a bizarre, hypocritical, and nonsensical thing, I should point out that he could as well have been joined in the Hall of Shame by a good portion of the rest of the Republican Party. You know, it seems the general position of Republicans with regard to President Obama's Syria policy is that President Obama is a limp-wristed pacifist warmonger who cowardly chose not to go forward with the airstrikes which we opposed. I'll give you all a moment to think about that statement. Colorado Republican Congressman Mike Kaufman is third place this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. But in second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have the entire Iowa State Legislature. There are times when I don't envy people in the various state legislatures and in Congress because of the gravity of the problems that they face. How to keep services going for people. How to create jobs. How to keep taxes from becoming too high. Those issues and the various details are very serious and complex issues. But it doesn't help, though, when any state legislature or Congress makes their jobs more difficult by considering and in some cases passing crazy legislation. This past week, the Iowa State Legislature passed a bill making it legal for blind people to get gun permits. You heard me correctly. Blind people can get a concealed permit to own a handgun in Iowa. What could go wrong, right? What's funny about this is that Stevie Wonder, the musician, joked about that back on CNN in January when he was talking about gun control issues in general. Presumably, I think that Stevie thought it could never happen, so he was joking around and he said, "Imagine me with a gun. It's just crazy." At least one Iowa sheriff doesn't think it's a good idea. The city of Delaware sheriff John LeClaire opined, quote, "I'm not an expert in vision. At what point do vision problems have a detrimental effect to fire a firearm? If you see nothing but a blurry mass in front of you, then I would say you probably shouldn't be shooting something." Can't say I disagree with that. As crazy as this new law is, what is just as crazy is that the Iowa State Legislature couldn't think of anything better to do with its time than to craft and debate bills that give guns to blind people. Iowa has $25 billion in debt, for instance. Why aren't lawmakers trying to find ways to pay that off? Iowa's unemployment rate is low, at around 4.8%, but it's still not low enough to consider it full employment. Why isn't the state legislature working to create jobs? How low on the list of priorities is it to consider whether the blind should have guns? The Iowa State Legislature is runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. But the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Bobby Wingate, is an African-American man who was walking down the street in Jacksonville, Florida last December. He was minding his own business, wasn't doing anything wrong, when a police officer came up to him and asked if he could talk to him. Mr. Wingate replied that he apologized, but he was late for an appointment. He couldn't stay to chat with the officer. The police officer then cited Wingate for walking on the wrong side of the street. Court papers indicate that the officer then punched Wingate in the face and engaged his taser on Wingate. At that point, Wingate called 911 asking for help. Imagine that, calling 911 asking for help because of the actions of a police officer. Wingate was then actually brought to trial on the charge of walking on the wrong side of the street. During the trial, the arresting officer gave testimony saying he wasn't sure which side of the street Wingate was on. Just gets better and better. The charge of walking on the wrong side of the street was then summarily dismissed by the judge. Now, as bad as all of this is, as I noted earlier, this happened in late December, to this date, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office has not initiated any kind of internal affairs investigation into the officer's conduct. And that officer remains on the job today. I have to ask the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, what kind of an outfit are you guys running out there? Where officers walk right up to people just walking down the street who aren't doing anything wrong, and if they indicate they're busy, you make up a charge against them and then hit them? And you don't think that warrants an investigation of some sort? Well, Mr. Wingate has retained an attorney, and he is suing the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. You know, all of this reminds me of a skit from an old British comedy called Not the 9 O'Clock News about a police officer called Constable Savage. Here's a piece from that skit.
You want to stay, sir? Ah, Constable Savage. Come in, shut the door. Yes. Now then, Savage. I want to talk to you about some charges that you've been bringing lately. I think that perhaps you're being a little overzealous.
Which charges do you mean then, sir?
Well, for instance, this one. Loitering with intent to use a pedestrian crossing. Maybe you're not aware of this, but it is not illegal to use a pedestrian crossing. Neither is smelling of foreign food an offence.
You sure, sir?
Also, there is no law against urinating in a public convenience or coughing without due care and attention.
If you say so, sir.
If I do say so, Savage. Did they teach you anything at training school?
Oh, sorry, sir.
They don't make them like that anymore here, or over the pond for that matter. In any case, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office wins the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you all for listening, and thank you to our special sponsor, Audible. Get your free audiobook and 30-day free trial at www.audiblepodcast.com/lasersense. The last part of that is spelled L-E-S-E-R. S-E-N-S-E, www.audiblepodcast.com/lasersense. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, September 22nd, and Monday, September 23rd at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me on the show on Twitter at Steven Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.